Here's a look at our headlines this hour. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says all illegal sanctions against Iran that are in breach of the 2015 deal must be removed. Britain's economy is showing signs of a stalling as the highest inflation in 40 years affects consumers' confidence. And Lebanese lawmakers are consulting with President Michelon to nominate a new prime minister for the crisis at country. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and Moscow are working on an agreement for long-term comprehensive cooperation.
We also discussed the treaty for comprehensive strategic and long-term cooperation between the two states. And this has been on our agenda prior to the trip by President Raisi to Russia. We hope to hold experts meeting very soon in order to finalize the contents of the agreement and also other matters on the agenda. We came up with very good agreements.
Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a joint press conference with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, in Tehran. He said the two countries are looking to expand bilateral trade and boost cooperation in various sectors, including railway transit. The top Iranian diplomat also commented on the war in Ukraine, saying the U.S. is using NATO to implement its agenda. The minister said Tehran believes a diplomatic approach is the only way to resolve the conflict. On the JCPOA revival talks, he said Tehran hopes the U.S. will take a realistic approach and remove the sanctions to pave the way for a final agreement on reviving the 2015 Iran deal. Lavrov, for his part, said Moscow fully supports the restoration of the JCPOA without any unacceptable additions.
We once again confirm to our Iranian friends that we will fully support their position about the revival of Iran's 2015 nuclear deal with no exceptions and unacceptable additions. This implies cancellation of all the illegal sanctions.
Lavrov said all illegal anti-Iran sanctions that contradict the JCPOA must be lifted. The Russian top diplomat said Moscow and Tehran condemn what he called unacceptable practice of illegal unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies. He said the two states are working to counter such measures. He said Moscow and Tehran both reject the concept of the so-called rule-based order prompted by Western powers. The numerous acts of sabotage that Israel has committed against Iran, from assassinating its nuclear scientists to damaging its nuclear facilities, are an open secret. But Iran says Israel's covert operations have weakened in the face of its security apparatus. The judiciary has revealed the arrest of three Mossad-linked agents who had the intent of killing Iranian nuclear scientists.
Iran has released fresh details about the covert and planned operations of agents of Israeli spy agency in Iran. Officials say the three agents detained back in April were planning to assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists. Officials say the agents were arrested following a complicated intelligence operation that lasted 8 months. Judiciary officials say some members of the cell have been arrested in Iran's southeastern Sistan and Balochistan province, while other members and operatives have been detained outside the province by Iran's intelligence forces. Officials say the case is under preliminary investigation and that an indictment would be filed and sent to court soon. This is not the first time Iran busts Mossad-linked terrorists. In July last year, Iran's intelligence ministry arrested a network of agents with the Israeli Mossad spy agency at the western borders, confiscating a large cache of weapons and ammunition that they were planning to use to provoke riots and terror inside the country.
Well, of course there should be, and I don't think anyone is really going to seriously say it's unthinkable that Israel would try to assassinate Iranian figures, whether in science or politics. They've got a demonstrable propensity to do so, and they boast about it.
The arrests come amid open threats by Israeli officials against Iranian nuclear scientists and facilities. The regime is notorious for its sabotage activities and assassinations in Iran.
And the reason behind its stepped-up hostility toward Iran and a very open hostility is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower of the region, as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Israel has been trying to halt Iran's civilian nuclear program throughout the years, but it's been unsuccessful. Those efforts include influencing the IAEA reports by providing the agency with false information about Iran's nuclear activities. Still, the failure of the international community in holding Israel to account has emboldened the regime to pursue its plots for assassination and sabotage.
Israel has tried various ways to stop Iran's nuclear progress. They include acts of sabotage, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, as well as threats to bomb Iran's nuclear installations. Probably the most high-profile assassination was the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a top Iranian nuclear scientist who was brutally murdered by Mossad agents in 2020. Mossad was involved in an explosion that hit Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in 2021. Israel was also the main regional force that pushed the United States to exert economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran. The policy culminated in the so-called maximum pressure campaign of former President Donald Trump. But none of those policies reached their stated goals. Iran's economy did not collapse, and its nuclear program has accelerated massively after the U.S. quit the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, in 2018.
It's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment, that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something greater. It carries out assassinations, there's no question about that. It carries out bombings inside the country, carried out by covert agents. I think right now the United States government is not wishing to see an escalation into a full-blown war. And Israel does, in the final analysis, have to pay attention to what Washington thinks and says.
Just recently, a top U.S. think tank admitted to Israel's failure towards Iran. A report by Atlantic Council said that Israel's policy has failed to stop Iran. The article said the Tel Aviv regime needs to recalculate and adopt a strategy that corresponds to the current state of the Iranian nuclear program. Given the current state of affairs, the United States, which is Israel's staunch ally, needs to reconsider its unilateral support for Israel.
The spokesman for the UN Secretary General has warned about the situation of Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, and the warning has been welcomed by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum says Stephane Dujarric's comments have put the spotlight on the suffering of the Palestinians in Gaza. He says the international community needs to pressure Israel into lifting the siege. Barhoum says the blockade constitutes a blatant violation of international law. On Monday, the UN official underscored the devastating impacts of the Gaza siege on the people there. He said about 80% of the Gaza population need humanitarian aid. He also said Israel's closure of crossings into Gaza must end, in line with a UN Security Council resolution. Iraqi parliament has sworn in new lawmakers to replace a bloc loyal to Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. 64 new members of parliament were sworn in, and 9 seats remain vacant in the assembly. This after the bloc of 73 Sadrist parliamentarians resigned en masse 2 weeks ago after months of stalemate over forming a new government. On Wednesday, Sadr dismissed allegations that Iran was interfering in Iraq's internal affairs, saying the Islamic Republic did not exert any pressure on any Shia party. An industry watchdog survey reveals Britain's economy is showing signs of stalling as high inflation threatens a recession in the United Kingdom. The S&P Global's Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, shows UK firms have been hit by a slowdown in new orders. Moreover, business confidence has fallen to its weakest since last year. In addition, UK private sector firms say demand has been hit by purchase hesitancy and squeezed budgets due to high inflation. June's PMI figures didn't change, showing the slowest economic growth rate in a year. Meanwhile, Britons are paying higher living costs and fuel prices as national inflation climbs to 9.1%. That's the highest it has been in the past 40 years. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati has been designated to form a new cabinet after the country's lawmakers consulted with President Aoun. To get more details about the matter, we earlier reached out to our Beirut-based correspondent, Maryam Saleh. Here's more.
We have just heard the statement from the Secretary General of the President of the Presidential Palace, who has declared that Mr. Najib Mikati has taken the highest number of votes. So Prime Minister Mikati has been designated as Prime Minister with 54 votes, if you may say, from the lawmakers of the Lebanese Parliament. Now, this is the first time that we have that slight majority. Before, there was always consensus, usually. The last time he was named as Prime Minister, he got 72 votes. Now what we do have is we have a lot of independent newcomers into the parliament. We also have groups who say they don't believe that Prime Minister Mikati can get Lebanon out of this crisis, despite the fact that his cabinet has already made their contracts and their agreements with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and they have also vows from the international community that they will be bailed out, that Lebanon will be bailed out as a crisis. But what he's trying to get is around $3 billion in assistance and funds, while Lebanon has, of course, a debt of over $70 billion. Now, this is, something that is a very important threshold for Lebanon, because we only have several months until the end of the term of President Michel Aoun, after which also the cabinet will have been resigned. And as you know, as the executive body of the country, they are the ones who have to do the hard work here in this country.
Now, as I said just moments ago, Iraq's parliament has sworn in new lawmakers to replace a bloc loyal to Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. To get more on that, I'm now joined by Navid Behrouz. He is the bureau chief of Al Olam Arabic TV channel in Baghdad. Mr. Behrouz, please go ahead.
Today, the Iraqi parliament has met, and they have pledged their vows instead of the former members of parliament. This is a way to end this political isolation and to form a new cabinet in Iraq. There are several groups like the Sunni group and the Kurdistani group who have been part of this agreement, and this shows the agreement and the consensus that is now present in Iraq. After this step, we will have a declaration of the biggest parliamentary bloc, which will be the beginning of a coordinated body, which allows us to begin with the consensus and agreements in the country. The second step would be to see an agreement and consensus between the two main Kurdistani groups on the naming of a president, or the name of the president who will be. These Kurdistani groups will be coming to the parliament to name their best candidate. This will be the case until we see an agreement. There is no agreement, then therefore the president will name a prime minister who can take this role. This is a very significant step for the Iraqi parliament, and this will establish the beginning of the coordination and necessary coordination and steps towards a cabinet in Iraq. For the sake of reforms of the infrastructure of the country and all the steps that need to be taken in order to make reforms in the country. whether it has to do with the petrol in the Kurdistan region and the portion of the Kurdistanis. This is a challenge for the country. This will not, this cabinet will not have an easy job, but it will need everyone's cooperation in order to be able to work through this vote and this vow. We see that there will be an opposition now outside the parliament, and we would see how that perhaps there will be calls for participation and partnership inside the cabinet. This is a step that was taken by the Iraqi parliament in order to have consensus and agreement between all the factions inside the parliament is a very significant step towards reform and towards a cabinet.
Mr. Navid Behrouz, the bureau chief of Al Olam Arabic TV channel in Baghdad, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us. Moving on. Rescuers are racing against time to pull survivors from the rubble the day after a powerful earthquake ripped through the mountainous border region in eastern Afghanistan. Heavy rains, rock falls, and inaccessible terrain are slowing down the operations. Some 1,000 people have lost their lives, and officials are expecting the death toll to rise. People are digging a large number of graves to bury the dead, mainly in Paktika province that has been hit the hardest. At least 1,500 others have been injured. A number of countries have offered emergency aid. Two humanitarian flights from neighboring Iran have already landed in Afghanistan. The UN says it's deploying health teams and supplies of medicine, food, and emergency shelter to the quake zone. China's President Xi Jinping has called on the leaders of BRICS countries to rise to their responsibilities and stand up against abuse of international sanctions. Addressing an online meeting of the bloc, the Chinese leader said the BRICS nations should abandon group confrontation and oppose unilateral sanctions. He said the bloc must act to inject positive, stable, constructive forces into the world. Speaking in the same online forum, President Putin of Russia called on the bloc to cooperate in the face of, quote, selfish actions from the West. He said Moscow was ready to further develop cooperation with the bloc. The BRICS countries comprise Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The European Parliament has voted to grant Ukraine immediate candidate status against the backdrop of efforts by Kiev to become a member of the European Union. With nearly 530 votes in favor and 45 opposed, the parliament adopted a resolution in favor of the candidacy status. This is the first step for Kiev towards joining the 27-member trade union. Ukraine will now face a complicated process of reforms that could take decades to complete before it actually becomes an official member. The move is symbolic of the EU's support for Ukraine and its face-off with Russia. President Putin of Russia has already made it clear Moscow has nothing against Ukraine joining the EU because it's an economic alliance, not a military one. Russia, however, is adamantly opposed to Ukraine becoming a NATO member. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to a report, the Israeli regime used weapons made and funded by the United States to destroy projects and businesses in the Gaza Strip during its devastating 11-day war on the besieged enclave last year. We present you an article written by Daniel Bogoslov. The piece is titled, Israel Used U.S. Weapons to Destroy Assets and Aid Projects in Gaza. The article has appeared on the front page of the Intercept website. Last May, in an assault on the occupied Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime deployed hundreds of bombs, missiles and shells, murdering over 240 Palestinians and wounding more than 1,900 others. Despite Zionist regime's claims that it only targets combatants from Hamas and other Palestinian resistance groups, more than half of the martyred were civilians. At the end of the 11-day assault, tens of thousands of Gazans were displaced from damaged homes, already struggling in a region with a 50% unemployment rate, toxic water, and crumbling infrastructure. Thousands of housing units, hundreds of schools, and 19 healthcare facilities were damaged. Documents and reporting reviewed by The Intercept show compounding the devastating toll on Palestinian civilians. Weapons made and funded by the United States were used to destroy humanitarian projects and businesses in Gaza. The destruction reached multiple hospitals, water treatment facilities, and dozens of schools operated by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA. Raad Jarar, Advocacy Director at Democracy for the Arab World Now, told The Intercept, the vast majority of ammunition used by Israel is manufactured or subsidized by the United States. Raad Jarar added, it's fair to say that every Israeli munition is subsidized by the United States one way or another by U.S. tax dollars. Impoverished in no small part thanks to a decade-and-a-half-long Israeli blockade, the Gaza Strip relies heavily on foreign aid to avert the worst humanitarian outcomes. According to documents compiled from the United Nations, the Palestinian Authority and human rights groups, more than 100 UNRWA facilities in Gaza were damaged in the 11-day bombing campaign in May of 2021, requiring over $1 million in repairs. Dozens more schools administered by the Palestinian Authority suffered similar damage. In 2014, during an earlier Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, a Hellfire missile manufactured and paid for by the United States targeted an UNRWA school, murdering 10 civilians. The massacre drew widespread condemnation, even eliciting a rare rebuke from the Obama administration, whose press secretary decried it as totally indefensible. Michael Link, the recently departed United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of humanitarian rights in the Palestinian territories, said a major reason for the perpetuation of Israeli occupation and the deaths and suffering which accompany it is the extraordinary military, diplomatic, and political support given to it, largely without conditions, by the United States. Michael Link added, "This American military assistance is provided, notwithstanding the fact that congressional laws governing U.S. weapons exports claim that recipient countries cannot be engaged in consistent patterns of gross human rights violations. While Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid, it is subject to virtually no checks in operation, ensuring that U.S. weapons are not used to commit war crimes, destroy United Nations-funded projects, or damage the property of civilians in the Gaza Strip. Since 1948, the United States has provided the Israeli regime with over $150 billion worth in assistance, receiving in exchange a foothold in a region of massive strategic importance. The current model exists under a Memorandum of Understanding that President Barack Obama signed in 2016, committing to $38 billion in aid between 2019 and 2028, with an open-door policy for additional aid, like the $1 billion Congress gave the Zionist regime in March for its Iron Dome missile defense system. The aid system also provides cash flow financing, a system resembling layaway that allows Israel to purchase weapons in the present using money from the future. And it contains an offshore procurement exemption offered to no other country that allows the Israeli regime to spend U.S. tax dollars on its own weapons industry without disclosing how it spent the money to Congress or the American public. And of course, the United States maintains its own stockpiled weapons in the occupied Palestinian territories, available for use by the Israeli forces, despite Israel's status as one of the largest arms exporters in the world. In two instances, Israel tapped into the U.S. stockpile to wage campaigns against the Palestinian resistance group Hamas and the Lebanese Islamic resistance movement Hezbollah. The end result is an Israeli arsenal almost entirely composed of weapons made or subsidized by the United States. As bombs fell on the Gaza Strip last May, the smell of roasting nuts and sizzling potatoes was replaced with the overwhelming stench of burnt plastic. A potato chip factory and a Matouk ice cream factory, which once produced snacks in the hope of instilling a glimmer of joy in the blockaded strip, were completely destroyed in the bombing. Many of the companies established in Gaza's industrial zone did so under the pretext that the Israeli military would not bomb the commercial site. Financed by U.S. aid and fired on by U.S.-funded weapons, the area was thought to be protected under the auspices of the Oslo Accords, which created a special economic zone intended to supplant conflict with mutually beneficial free trade. Also impacted were the Foamco mattress factory, the main producer of mattresses for Gaza, the Abu Iskandar plastic factory, the Clever detergent factory, the Siksik plastic pipes factory, and the Al-Wadi food plant, resulting in tens of millions of dollars worth of damage. The factories employed 1,500 Palestinians and were severely impacted by the shelling in the early morning hours on 17th and 18th of May 2021. The Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, which received a $900,000 grant from UNAID to build a surgery center, was also damaged in the Israeli bombing campaign, as was Beit Hanun Hospital, another recipient of UNAID funding. while mechanisms for punishing war crimes perpetrated with U.S. support are selectively enforced against many other countries, the lack of scrutiny over the Israeli regime's forces' use of American weaponry is glaring. Amid last May's onslaught, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace detailed a number of U.S. laws violated by Israel's attacks on Gaza. These included the Foreign Assistance Act, which stipulates that aid cannot be provided to a country which engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. Also, the Arms Export Control Act, which bans U.S. military assistance to countries using weapons for reasons other than legitimate self-defense. And the Leahy Laws, named after outgoing U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, which ban weapon sales to military units that have committed a gross violation of human rights. In May of 2021, as last year's bombing campaign drew to a close, Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, and several progressive members of the House of Representatives introduced resolutions to block a $735 million weapons package that included the same type of precision-guided bombs that the Israeli regime was already using to shell Gaza. Senator Bernie Sanders said at the time, "I believe that the United States must help lead the way to a peaceful and prosperous future for both Israelis and Palestinians. We need to take a hard look at whether the sale of these weapons is actually helping do that or whether it is simply fueling conflict." But the White House demurred. Then White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki claimed, "We have seen reports of a move towards a potential ceasefire that is clearly encouraging." The Biden administration approved the sale. This May, Israel launched another bombing campaign on the Gaza Strip.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files. Welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, the target of journalists is usually considered a very important piece of news, at least when the culprit is not a U.S. ally. But the systematic targeting of journalists by Israel is barely considered news. You see, Yasser was only one of the many cases of murdered journalists that mainstream media let Israel get away with. Since 2000, some 55 journalists, that's 55, have been murdered by the Israeli regime. And I'll bet unless you're Palestinian, you can't name a single one off the top of your head, except for perhaps Shireen Abu Akhle. Shireen Abu Akhle was a Palestinian-American journalist. She had worked over two decades for Al Jazeera, covering the illegal occupation of Palestine and the systematic oppression of its people. And on May 11th, Shireen had gone to cover yet another Israeli attack on a Palestinian refugee camp in the West Bank. And then this happened.
An Al Jazeera journalist has been shot and killed in the occupied West Bank. Shireen Abu Akla was a well-known Palestinian reporter covering the Israeli army raid on the Jenin refugee camp when she was shot in the head. The 51-year-old was wearing a helmet and body armour clearly marked as press. Another Palestinian journalist, Ali Samoudi, who was working as Abu Akla's producer, was shot in the back during the same attack. He said that the first shot missed them and the second struck him and the third, Abu Akla. Al Jazeera has accused the IDF of deliberately attacking the journalist.
Details are key in this story. Details that are impossible to deny as both the footage and witnesses confirm them. Important details like these. One, there were no gunshots before Shireen was killed. She was not killed by accident in the midst of some clash between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers. Two, Shireen was targeted, even though she was clearly marked as a journalist wearing her press vest. She was shot dead somehow, despite even having that bulletproof vest and helmet on, and after two shots had already missed her. And three, the shooting continued after Shireen was shot, each time when others tried to reach her. And yet, this is how the mainstream media chose to cover the story. From Al Jazeera reporting how New York Times had reported it that said basically that the Palestinian journalist dies, not killed. Of course, the New York Times changed it later on after Al Jazeera exposed the words that they had used were not correct. Now, this is from Associated Press, as we see. Shireen, a journalist for the Al Jazeera network, was killed by gunfire in the occupied West Bank. Now, the Palestinian Health Ministry says the shooting happened during an Israeli army raid in Jenin. Again, was killed here by gunfire. By whose gunfire? Who fired? And from the New York Times, Al Jazeera journalist is killed in West Bank. The network and Palestinian authorities blame Israeli troops for the killing. Israel said the blame could lie with Palestinian gunmen. And, of course, we saw later on that that also was proven to be an untruth. Again, this is how the mainstream media has reported about the murder of Shireen Abu Akleh, and this is just a few examples. Now, if this can happen to a senior journalist from a major news network, what do lesser-known Palestinian journalists have to deal with on a daily basis? Well, stay with us as we talk to one of these brave journalists.
Wafa Al-Odeini is a Gaza-based journalist. She is a reporter and writer for several international publications, such as Middle East Monitor. Wafa leads a group of young journalists and activists called 16th of October Group.
Welcome to the program, and thanks so much for being with us. Tell me, what is it like being a journalist in Gaza?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. To be a journalist here in Palestine, and in particular in Gaza, it is not an easy task or interesting task. It's so risky indeed, because we are subject to brutal policy occupation. We don't have immunity. We are subject to Israeli occupation fire in any time. We don't take risks indeed, since there is occupation in Palestine. Since nearly 2000, nearly 55 Palestinian journalists were murdered, and dozens got injured and maimed. Some of them lost their parts of their body. And here in Gaza, indeed, there is no immunity at all for Palestinian journalists. We can't move freely inside occupied Palestine, for example. So none of the journalists are allowed to exit Gaza, maybe to cover incident in the West Bank or in occupied Jerusalem. None of us is allowed to go there and cover anything there. So we are just stuck here in Gaza and covering the Israeli brutalities and the offensive against the people here in Gaza. And yet, also, they target us.
Well, tell me, what were your thoughts when you heard about Shireen's murder?
Actually, it was really a very sad morning. We woke up on an extremely heartbreaking news. Really, we cried over her when we heard the news. Shireen is a great loss for Topaz. For us as journalists, this is not shocking, but it served as a reminder to us that, hey, don't forget, you are going to be next target. So she is not the first journalist to be targeted. I'm sure she will not be the last.
And do you think that the Israeli regime will be held accountable for her murder?
Okay, so I think this is what the Israeli occupation is doing. They try to increase the anger of the people by saying that they are going to investigate in these crimes, but it doesn't make any sense. They are not going to investigate any of these crimes. And if they are really sorry for her killing, so why when the people came to rescue her, they fired at those who came to rescue Shireen? They fired at them. They couldn't take her directly after being shot. I mean, like, yeah, they see that the journalist got, injured, and then she was laying on the ground. So they have to come and to rescue her if they are really right, or if they, they can come and rescue her. But they didn't do anything, and even they shot at those who came to rescue her. And the other thing also, during her funerals, while so many people were there and they were just holding her coffin, and the coffin was there was a Palestinian flag. They attacked those mourners and they attacked the coffin, and it was about to fall down, but the people, I mean the mourners, they didn't allow it to fall down. But they attacked them, and nearly 35 Palestinian mourners who were in her funeral got injured by the occupation police. So how come they just feel sorry and they are going to investigate in her killing while they are doing something else?
Thank you so much for being with us out of Gaza. Well, when asked to investigate the killing of Shireen, the spokesman of the Israeli military had openly said that these journalists were armed with cameras. Imagine that. So clearly, the Israeli regime is given impunity. And not only in targeting journalists at will, but also in attacking the mourners in the funeral procession, if they allow them to have one to begin with. But how is this possible? We do know what makes this possible financially. The U.S. alone, for instance, has been giving the Israeli regime more than $10,400,000 a day. That's $10,400,000 every day, money that's almost entirely spent on the Israeli military. The U.S. also promotes using Israeli products and has banned boycotting Israeli products in some 35 states. Even mentioning Israeli crimes is deemed as anti-Semitic and forbidden and attacked in academic circles. And that's the U.S. alone. Just recently, the Queen of England, the country which created the illegal entity of Israel, spoke against allowing for movements like BDS to boycott Israel inside of the U.K. But are these restrictions on personal freedoms legal in the U.S.? Well, we're going to be joined by a special guest to let us know his take on that.
Professor George Bisharat is a cum laude graduate of Harvard Law School. In 1989, Professor Bisharat published a book, Palestinian Lawyers and Israeli Rule, Law and Disorder in the West Bank. In 1991, Bisharat became professor of law at the University of California's Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco, California, a position he continues to hold. Professor Bisharat is a frequent commentator to the media on the issue of Palestine.
Oh, welcome, Professor Bisharat, and thanks so much for joining us. Let's talk about the legality or the lack thereof of Israel in targeting journalists, as there have been 55 of them killed since 2000.
Yes. Well, yes, this is a long pattern of Israel's disregard, actually not only of journalists, also of medics and other people in the occupied territories and elsewhere. and following impunity, that is the sort of lack of any consequence, any prosecution, any proper investigation of this wrongdoing. And in photojournalists, or journalists, I should say, in particular, there have been something like 86 Palestinian journalists killed since 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank. And just since 2018, there have been something like 144, according to Reporters Without Borders, who have been attacked in one way or another, either with tear gas or beatings with clubs, or with rubber bullets, or with live ammunition. So this is a very common thing. And actually, three civil society organizations had, just before the killing of Shirin Abu Ali, had brought a complaint, I should say, to the International Criminal Court concerning the killing of Palestinian journalists.
I don't know what to say.
The saddest news to wake up to.
A woman.
A Christian.
A Palestinian.
Shireen.
Shireen.
Sweet was her name, her memory.
A household name across the Middle East.
For her decades of reporting in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories.
A voice of the voiceless.
She had her press vest on.
They shot her in the face while covering the attack in Jenin refugee camp.
Israeli soldiers shot at us directly without provocation. One bullet hit me, and another hit Shireen.
They killed her in cold blood.
They are specialized in killing.
It is part of Israel's systematic and well-documented policy of targeting journalists.
This state-sponsored Israeli terrorism must stop.
Palestinians are not human beings to the Israelis.
Is Shireen human enough for you?
So say something.
Do something.
Break the silence. Unconditional support to Israel must end.
Where is the same energy and humanity that was used to cover the Khashoggi case?
Accountability?
We know this won't apply to Israel, as it doesn't to America.
I started following Shireen today.
We are all Shireen.
We're all Shireen.
We are all Shireen.
We are all Shireen.
We're all Shireen.
Well, from a legal perspective, Professor, can you talk about laws that Israel violates regarding the treatment of Palestinians?
Well, there are many, of course. There are home demolitions, there are arrests there are detentions. There is torture, there are killings, there are other forms of, you know, lesser physical abuse, but still considerable beatings and the like. And land confiscation, the creation of civilian settlements, actually a war crime under both the Geneva Convention and under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. But the most important thing, I think, to grasp and to keep in mind is that all of these individual violations are in the service of enforcing a broader systemic system of apartheid. And that is also a war crime under the Rome Statute, and it is now the subject of possible criminal investigation by the International Criminal Court. And of course, an apartheid system is one that involves inhumane acts under international law anyway, is a system that engages in any one of a number of inhumane acts, including killings like the killing of Shireen Abu Ali. In order to establish and maintain a system of racial domination over another group. And of course, that's exactly what we have in Israel, in its domination of the Palestinian people, whether within Israel itself or within the occupied territories. And of course, this reality of the apartheid system has been documented by highly respected human rights organizations and others, including the Israeli organization B'Tselem, including probably the preeminent human rights organization in the world, Human Rights Watch, including Amnesty International, and including UN bodies as well, including most recently the Special Rapporteur for the occupied territory. So I think that the killing has to be understood as a part of this broader systemic crime.
What do you make of some Western countries like the United States and the United Kingdom attempting to make supporting the boycott, divestment, and sanctioned movement against Israel illegal? I mean, how is that possible in these liberal countries?
Well, it's highly hypocritical, to say the least. I also think that it is a fundamental sign of weakness and of a realization that that increasing numbers of people, common people, not necessarily in the political class, who understand the realities of Israeli apartheid and are willing to take action to change it. I think the political class, which is largely subject to pressures from Israel supporters, and who many of them themselves hold the ideology or similar parallel ideologies, which lead them to support Israel in one way or another. The political class sees that they're losing their grip on their constituencies. Increasing numbers of people here in the United States, for example, are sympathetic to Palestinian rights. They want to see justice. They want to see equal rights. They don't understand why it should be okay for one people to rule over others, to have all rights for themselves, and to deprive Palestinians of their rights. B'Tselem called the character of the Israeli regime as one of Jewish supremacy from the river to the sea, in all of former Palestine, that is Israel itself and the occupied territories, a form of Jewish supremacy.
Thanks so much, Professor Bishnat, for being with us right here on Hidden Files. It's true that these journalists are being targeted and killed by the Israeli military. Naturally, the very goal of an occupation would be to eliminate the rightful owner of the land, and doing so in the absence of media coverage is much easier. Therefore, Israel cannot be blamed for acting in accordance to its goals. The entities that are to blame, however, are the mainstream media, whose goal is supposed to be a fair coverage to educate the masses, and the so-called international community that's supposedly there to maintain peace and equality, but only acts to give legitimacy to the crimes of those in power and to silence popular resistance, the resistance of people who have little to fight with other than stones and cameras, people like Yasser Murtaja. And by the way, he was shot while documenting the Great Palestinian March of Return. I'll join you next week with yet another Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.